Welcome. Glad to have you here. Mike asked me to do a class on preaching James, and I am glad to do that. James is not an area of expertise that I have, but wisdom literature is, and James is a wisdom type of book, heavily influenced by wisdom. So I was delighted to accept the offer. Let me share with you the lowdown on what I want to do today and tomorrow, and so you know where we're going. What I want to do initially is to just give like a 2-minute overview of the book and its what I see as its primary focus. And then I want to deal with or address several preliminary kinds of perspectives that I feel will be helpful for preaching James or teaching James. I mean, some of you aren't preaching, but many of you, maybe most of you, are teaching, and I feel that these kinds of things will go either way. So I want to give several, about five preliminary perspectives or observations that I believe are especially helpful for preaching and teaching this book. And then one of the ways that I feel is really good to preach and teach James is thematically. James has oftentimes been accused of having a very chaotic kind of structure. In other words, no structure. That has changed, and I'll mention a little more about that in a moment. That has changed. And scholars now see a more intentional structure to the book. The problem is they don't all agree on what that structure is. But James is made up of a series of discourses, and he emphasizes certain themes. And I feel one very effective way of teaching and preaching this book is to do so thematically. So I want to focus in on, if you will, three themes in the book of James. And then after that, depending upon how much time we have tomorrow, I want to deal with a couple of texts, just zero in on a couple of texts and suggestions for teaching and preaching them. And then end tomorrow with about a 5-minute, I know this sometimes isn't all that helpful, but a 5-minute overview of bibliography. And I have a bibliographic handout that I will give tomorrow, and I'll just highlight some of the things on that. It's just 2 pages front and back, and I'll highlight some of the things, some of the resources that I feel are most helpful for probing into this book. So that's the lay of the land, and that's what plan to do today and into tomorrow. I'm not sure how far we will get today. We'll just play that by ear. But let me give you an overview of an overall perspective of what I see the letter of James to be about. I think it is a letter. It is primarily a letter of moral instruction. This is James wants to produce godly character. And the way I like to put it is that the book of James is the New Testament's way of putting godliness in working clothes. This is how godliness looks when it's in the trenches. And yes, God does accept us as we are, most definitely. But God is not content to leave us as we are. And that's where the book of James comes in. God has accepted us as we are, you know, warts and sins and all the chinks in our armor. He's accepted us as we are, but he does not want to leave us as we are. And James, that is where James really hones in on. And it's pretty harsh. Some people say that have said that James is a really practical book. Actually, it's really impractical because these are all countercultural kinds of of issues that he is addressing and wants his audience to face up to and challenges them to deal with. So James is not so much a how-to book as it is a how-to-be or how-to-become book. And once a Christian is moving in a direction of character maturity, of maturing character, once a Christian is moving in that direction, with the ups and downs, obviously, but moving in that direction, as Eugene Peterson says, a long obedience in the same direction. Once we're moving in that direction, then everything else in life falls into place. Our responsibilities to others, our responsibility to the poor, to the marginal, our responsibility to the rich, our responsibility to our families. But character that we are called to develop is what James is really after. And in our day and time, that's critical. As Christians, who we are becoming is really central and core to what we need to develop. I want to share with you a little clip. I see here the theme of the book of James, and you could come at this actually from different places in James, but I chose the passage where he talks about wisdom when he says, "Who is wise and understanding among you? Show by your good life, that your works are done with gentleness, born of wisdom." I think that really gets to the core, the moral, if you will, of what James is about. Now, I want to show a video clip. This is a video clip, a little 2-minute video clip by N.T. Wright. Actually, I've edited it out of a larger lecture that he delivered a few years ago to a Doctor of Ministry class at Fuller Seminary. But I think it gets us on the track of what James is trying to get at. And so that's why I wanted to show this clip. Actually, later he wrote a book, and he shares this example and develops it even fuller in that book, After You Believe. Some of you may be familiar with it. This first one of the first volumes is Surprised by Joy, and this one is After You Believe. So I find what he says to help, hopefully help us get focused on what James is really trying to accomplish. I'll have to start it over again.
Carolina. 2 minutes to take off, the aircraft ran into a flock of geese. Both the engines... You remember what happened. Flight 1549 took off from LaGuardia, bound for Charlotte, North Carolina. 2 minutes after takeoff, the aircraft ran into a flock of geese. Both the engines were badly damaged. They lost power. The plane was then heading north over the Bronx, and instantly the captain, Chesley Sullenberger, and his co-pilot had to make several major decisions. They could see one or two small airports not far away, but they realized they couldn't guarantee getting that far. And likewise, putting the plane down on the New Jersey Turnpike was probably not going to be easy or safe. That left one option, the Hudson River. It's not easy to crash land safely on water. And in the 2 or 3 minutes they had, not a long time, before they hit the water, the captain and co-pilot had to do a whole host of vital things. They shut down the engines, they set the right speed so the plane could glide as long as possible without power. They had to get the nose of the plane down to maintain speed, but then get it up again before hitting the water. They had to disconnect the autopilot, override the flight management system. They had to activate the ditch system, which seals vents and valves to make the plane waterproof. Most of all, they had to fly and then glide the plane in a fast, sharp left-hand turn so they could come down facing south, going with the flow of the Hudson River. Then they had to straighten the plane up from the tilt of the turn, so that on landing it would be exactly level. And finally, they had to get the nose back up again, but not too far up, and land straight and flat on the water. That at least is a small list of some of the key things they had to do in a couple of minutes. There are probably several others that we amateurs wouldn't even understand, but they did it. As you know, everyone got off safely. So, many described the incident as a miracle. And at one level, I wouldn't want to question that. But to me, the really fascinating thing about the whole business is the way it spectacularly illustrates a vital truth, a truth which many today have either forgotten or never known in the first place. You could call it the power of acquired habits. You might say it was the result of many years of training and experience. The ancient writers would have called it virtue. Virtue in this sense isn't simply another word for goodness. Virtue in this strict sense is what happens when someone has made 1,000 small decisions requiring effort and concentration to do something which is good and right but which doesn't come naturally.
Okay. Well, that's just a little taste of what he is trying to develop. The reason I wanted to share this with you is because, you know, he is talking about virtue and how virtue is formed. And that's what James is doing. How is virtue formed? And we'll talk more about that when we get to one of the themes, character development through endurance. That is really important for James. And that really underlies, most everything that James says. What I want to do is to look at some preliminary perspectives here that I feel will be helpful as we approach this material for however we want to use it in a classroom or from the pulpit. And the first one here is that this is a wisdom book. James is, it's not, maybe I should say, it's not pure wisdom, because it does differ some from some of the wisdom literature, but it is really closely related to wisdom material, and that's just important to keep in mind. The way I like to define wisdom, in the Old Testament, you hear this word being used with different kinds of skills. In other words, someone who is skilled in the art of, some kind of artisan work, some kind of bricklayings. Sailors are often described as those who have wisdom. Basically, wisdom is used to describe a skill or an expertise that someone has in a particular vocation. When it comes to wisdom material, when it comes to the book of James, wisdom is that expertise of learning how to negotiate the complexities of life. How is it that we can develop skills and expertise in managing all the issues and life's challenges that come at us every day? Wisdom is concerned about Christian behavior and how the wise person is to act. And and I'm not going to develop this much, I just want to bring it up here. It looks at nature for insights. And as you go all through the book of James, over and over again, he continually uses examples from nature and creation to illustrate or make analogies about a deeper lesson that he is trying to communicate. I believe that in whatever capacity, whether you're a preacher or a teacher in a church, I believe that we should strive for those qualities that a sage or a wise person has. And they include, fundamentally, a strong moral character. That is the fundamental definition of a wise person, one who is exemplifies strong character. And in our churches today, churches need leaders who exemplify that kind of character, integrity, authenticity, in their lives. Other characteristics of a sage or of a wise person are that they are God-fearers. God is at the center of life, not self. They are those who are attentive to what is going on around and learn from other people. They are good listeners. They are good observers. They are participant observers. They are individuals who approach life with a balanced life. They are not workaholics, but neither are they lazy. So all of these qualities of a wise person or a sage, I believe, is something that we, in whatever leadership capacity we have, need to work at developing and embracing in our lives. So that's the first little preliminary observation that I would like to make. Second here has to do with structure. And that is, James really assumes the gospel message. He assumes it. He doesn't talk about it, but he assumes it. James does not talk it, because he's in the wisdom tradition, he doesn't talk about the mighty acts of God. So you don't have references to miracles, except, I guess, the example of Elijah in the Old Testament. But you don't have examples of miracles. James doesn't talk specifically about the death and resurrection of Jesus. He doesn't talk about the birth of Jesus. He doesn't talk about any of those mighty acts of God. He assumes them and builds his case for moral development on that gospel message. Now, one of the downsides and one of the reasons, as we've heard throughout this week, why James really has been neglected is that, well, for one thing, I mean, just the whole history. You know what Martin Luther said about the book of James. It's a strawy epistle. I also found out, and I have this in the bibliography if you want to look at it for yourself. But not only did he call it a strawy epistle, he said on one occasion that he wanted to throw Jimmy in the stove. And I thought that was kind of an interesting type of way of talking about the book of James. But James has not had a good history, at least in Protestantism. It's not a list of rules, even though, I mean, there are more than 100 imperatives in this book. There are more imperatives in the book of James than there is in any other book in the Bible. And sometimes, if you're pessimistic about that, then one of the things I like to say is that you could view reading James like taking a long road trip with your mom. Because over and over, I mean, just a rapid fire imperatives. Don't do this, don't do that, do this, do that. You know, pick up your socks, change your clothes, take a shower, all those things that your mom would say. You've got this all in James. And so he gets a bad rap because of that. But that's a misunderstanding. And let me emphasize that. That's a misunderstanding of the book of James. He is really intense about this whole concern for character development. In terms of structure, chapter 1, and I will look at these themes in just a moment, but chapter 1 is really an introduction to the whole book. In chapter 1, what you have are all the themes that the rest of the book of James deals with. So chapter 1 is an introduction, and then chapters 2 through 5 really are the developing of those themes. And I'll share those themes with you in just a moment. But it is the book is organized around discourses and themes and clusters, and that's one of the reasons why I feel a very helpful way of addressing and teaching and preaching James is to do so thematically. Some would say that the structure of James is really chaotic, but there is a structure. And as we go along here, I'd like to reveal at least some of the things that I
feel are important about how he has organized his letter. This is basically the way in which he begins and ends his discourses. Each discourse begins with an opening rhetorical question, or accompanied by brothers and sisters. My brothers and sisters, do this or that. So that's a key as to when he begins another discourse. Now, you do have two discourses near the end, and Sarah Barton mentioned that they were a part of her sermon in the lecture this morning. You do have two discourses that begin with "Come now." Come now, in chapter 4, verse 13, and then "Come now," in chapter 5, verse 1. So those begin that way rather than with the more affectionate brothers and sisters. And then each discourse appears to be closed by a short proverbial type of saying. You can go through and see that. So that it may be kind of some marks for when he begins and when he concludes a particular theme that he's addressing. All right, a third preliminary observation, and that is he grounds his instruction in God. James is primarily theocentric, not Christocentric. He's theocentric. As you probably know, James only mentions Christ twice. Chapter 1, verse 1, and then chapter 2, verse 1. Those are the only times that he mentions Christ. As opposed to a couple of dozen times, he talks about God, God the Father, God as Lord. That just permeates James. And I believe a lot of our, as steeped, if you will, or as James grows out of the gospel story, he really is. He very much accepts the whole life and story of his brother. I take it his brother. He accepts that whole life of it. But he focuses his instruction on the nature of God and who God is and what God expects and what God demands from us. And I believe our preaching and our teaching needs to be more theocentric, more God-centered. In one way that bridges some barriers that sometimes we might have with certain individuals, but a God-centered approach is what James does. And as you may know, James nowhere mentions the Holy Spirit. So nowhere the Holy Spirit is mentioned. Only two times is Christ's name mentioned, so it is. He's clearly theocentric in his approach to moral issues and character development. Maybe one passage here that indicates that is in the first chapter, which again is an introduction, where he says in chapter 1, verse 17, "Every generous act of giving with every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change." And that really sets the tone for what he's grounding his message in. All right, a fourth observation here, preliminary observation, and that is James' relationship to the Sermon on the Mount. James only quotes Jesus once in this book. But what he's done is, and actually Scott McKnight pointed this out several years ago to a few of us who were with him on one occasion, What James does is to embody the Sermon on the Mount. He assimilates it. He doesn't quote it, but every step of the way, and I'll show you some of these parallels here, every step of the way he alludes to it. He has embraced the whole sermon. Let me give you some examples here. This may be kind of a difficult slide to see, but the only time he quotes directly from the Sermon on the Mount is in chapter 5, verse 12. Let your yes be yes and your no, no. But there are just numerous allusions all the way along to the sermon and Jesus teaching there. And also there are allusions to Leviticus 19. Sarah mentioned that this morning, Leviticus 19:18, and love your neighbor as yourself. And I have on this slide here quotations from Leviticus. He doesn't quote Leviticus. I shouldn't have said that, but he alludes to it in these different places. Now, actually, this is also a little unfair because, Leviticus 19 really is a summary of a lot of the teaching of the whole Old Testament. So it's not like he's just zeroing in on one chapter in the Old Testament. Regarding this whole allusion to the Sermon on the Mount, Scott McKnight has a phrase that I really like, and that is receptive reverence. In other words, James has taken, because of James's teaching in the letter, is not his own. He has received it from his brother. It's been receptive to it. And that reception is an act of reverence. And that's what James, what Scott means by receptive reverence. It really is the epitome of what wisdom is all about. Wisdom is a wise person is one who listens well. Listens well and then assimilates that which is, discerns what is important, assimilates that, and then takes that new understanding into a new context and shares it in that context in a new way. That's exactly what James is doing. He's taking, if you will, the Sermon on the Mount, embodied it, and now not quoting him, but rather recasting it in a new form for a new context. Receptive reverence, probably the real epitome of what wisdom is about. And finally, James' letter is addressed to the whole community. I think this is really important, especially in our American culture with its individualism. I use James 1:27 here. It addresses both community and individual. I mean, James doesn't excise the individual by any means. He does address the individual. In 1:27, there's the care for the orphans and the widows. That's to be a community responsibility, but also the individual. Here again is this character development. The individual is to be unstained by the world, and that's a phrase that he will use again later on. There are several explicit references to the community responsibility, but there are more than these as well. This is where I think it's important. When you go out, when we go out and do a good deed to someone, what's typically the response? The response is, wow, that's, you really did, we really appreciate that. You are really a good person. And we might say, no, it's not me, it's God. And that's good. But the person who sees us do that good work is focused on us, or might say, man, you must come from a wonderful family, or your parents must be wonderful. They must have really raised you well. And so the emphasis,
whether we like it or not, and however hard we try not to put the focus on us, it oftentimes is, whether we want it or not. When the church does good works, it is much easier for the community, for others, to give the glory than to God, rather than to an individual. Is that making sense? When a community engages in outreach kinds or service kinds of activities or involved in community life, the community will say, well, that was a wonderful church. And it is much easier to point the and give the credit to God. I think that's one thing that we have really lost in our understanding of the importance of a whole community, a community that is morally mature. Yes, it starts with individuals, but it's a whole community that becomes morally responsible. So that's why I say that James' theme song might be Get Right Church. How many hymns do we have that are directed to the church? I don't know many. I don't know many at all. This is one that is. An exhortation for the church to get right. You know, get on board and don't miss that train as it comes through. Get your community life together. So James is addressed to the whole community. All right. The remaining 15 minutes, I want to at least get to one of the themes that I want to hold up as an example. The themes, as I said earlier, are summarized in chapter 1, and here they are right here. By the way, if you do want like this keynote or PowerPoint, I put it on PDF, so let me know and I'll get it to you, and you don't have to worry about copying everything down, but I do have it on PDF that I can send to you in one way or another. These are the themes that are mentioned in chapter 1 that James continues to develop all through the rest of his letter. And what I want to do is just highlight the first three there. And then also tomorrow we'll look at a couple of specific texts. But begin here with these themes. And the first one, character formation through endurance. Chapter 1, so here's the first theme. Chapter 1, verses 2 through 4. My brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of any kind, consider it nothing but joy, because you know that the testing of your faith produces endurance. And let endurance have its full effect, so that you may be mature and complete, lacking in nothing. And then verse 12. Blessed is any, and by the way, basically in verses 2 through 12, James is talking about external trials. And then when he gets over through to verse 13 and following, he speaks of internal temptations. And I think that's a helpful distinction there, because sometimes we get a little confused about between testing and temptation. External testing versus internal temptations in verses 13 through 19. But verse 12, the end of this opening section. Blessed is anyone who endures temptation. Such a one has stood the test and will receive the crown of life that the Lord has promised to those who love him. And then one other example here over in chapter 5, verse 7. James says, be patient, therefore, beloved, until the coming of the Lord. The farmer waits for the precious crop of the earth, being patient with it until it receives the early and the late rains. You must also be patient. Strengthen your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is near. Beloved, do not grumble against one another, so that you may not be judged. See, the judge is standing at the doors. As an example of suffering and patience, beloved, take the prophets
who spoke in the name of the Lord. Indeed, we call blessed those who showed endurance. You have heard of the endurance of Job, and you have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. So James sees at the basis of the whole development of faith. You have the testing of faith, and that testing of faith involves endurance, perseverance, and once that is in, and when we endure, then maturity and completeness are the result. I think this is a very important theme in the book of James. We live in a culture, and this goes back now to N.T. Wright's little example of all the effort involved in the plane being safely landed on the Hudson River. We live in a culture where genuineness is determined by spontaneity. If you have to practice something over and over again, that's not genuine, you know? That really is not. It has to be spontaneous. Virtue, character, is learned by practice. Honesty is learned by practicing. I like the little, there's a little poem that goes, sow a thought, reap an act. Sow an act, reap a habit. Sow a habit, reap a character. Sow a character, reap a destiny. That's that, you know, it starts with the little things. Starts with the little things and really, you know, in many ways, unnoticeable. We don't notice that process, but we stay at it. We practice it. There's a difference between trying and training. There's a difference. Somebody steps up to the line to run a marathon and decides that day, I'm going to try to run a marathon. That person's not going to get very far. If a person steps up to the line on a marathon, has been training for the last several years, arduous training, that's the difference. Trying and training, there's a huge difference between trying to play a violin and training to play a violin. Do you remember, they're still on the advertisements, commercials, the get rid of cable commercials, DirecTV. I don't like the current ones, to be quite honest. I don't like that Rob Lowe one, but be that as it may. The earlier ones started with the guy who was frustrated about his cable reception. He couldn't get good reception. Or he couldn't get the channel that he wanted. Or he couldn't get a person to help him out, you know, with what he wanted. Or he couldn't record it. And so there was either a frustration or a level of anger or anxiety or whatever. And then that little frustration led to a little larger act, to a larger act, to a larger act, until finally the guy's in the ditch, you know. And, I mean, it's just disastrous. Or he drives his car into a pizza place. Or does something really horrendous. That's that, you know, sow a thought, reap an act, sow an act, reap a habit, sow a habit, reap a character, sow a character, reap a destiny. It's difficult. It's arduous. That's why James is not practical. James is demanding. He's very demanding. And if we present it in any other way, then we really aren't being true to James's his character. And what his message is all about. Virtues, as N.T. Wright says, virtues are learned. They are learned. We aren't born with them. As Sully was not born to fly a plane, it was the little things over and over and over and over and over again until they become automatic. And so in just a couple of minutes' time, Sully is able to do two dozen different things that need to be done in order to land that plane safely on the Hudson River. That's the way character is developed. We do it over and over and over again until we learn to control temper. until we learn to honesty and other virtues as well. Okay, we have 5 minutes. I'll tell you what, let me stop right there. We'll do the two remaining ones. I want to look at genuine faith tomorrow and respect for all, and then deal with one and maybe, if we have time, two specific texts. Let me stop and see if there are observations, questions, or things that you feel are important to know. Yeah.
How would you preach a very straightforward, pretty plain book like James inductively?
Mm.
So I think sometimes that's a challenge.
Right. That's true. Yeah. How would you preach James inductively? In other words, rather than just kind of hitting it head on with you need to get your life right, then how would you come at it from another angle? Possibly, Scott, I would say N.T. Wright might offer one example. We're talking about going against our culture that is you know, really excises is concerned about instant gratification and excises any kind of endurance or practice or repetitive act as being disingenuous, and taking an example like that and working from the backside to get to a point where, hey, this is a daily type of routine and responsibility that we have to develop. That's one possibility. So good question. Somebody else? Any other?
And you probably don't have time to address this, but I mean, you know, as you talked about John Calvin earlier, one of the reasons why he didn't like Jimmy too much was, I suppose, because of the warps and faith concept.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of people see a kind of a discord between what Paul's teaching and what James
right.
is teaching. I don't think there is, but I think some misunderstanding.
Yep.
What do you think?
Well, and that's, Willie, I'm glad you brought that up because, I wasn't going to get into it, but the scholarship these days, as I've read over the last couple of months on James, they have completely gone away from that and said, I mean, James has, you're right, James is not even concerned about Paul. I mean, he's not responding to Paul at all. What I would say is that James is emphasizing, for lack of a, maybe this is a good a way to put it, James is emphasizing the exhortation sections of Paul, if you will, in his letters, you know, the what we call the parenetic sections, the exhortations, the admonitions. You know, you come to the end of Paul's letters, and he has these admonitions. That's what James is emphasizing, and James just assumes the gospel story. And the other night when Josh Ross was preaching and he brought in at the end of his sermon as he was talking about James, he brought in the cross of Christ and what Christ has done. I think that's appropriate, you know, I mean, to remind our audience. What James is doing, and one of the reasons that he is more theocentric, I believe, than Christocentric, is that he's speaking, remember chapter 1, verse 1? He's speaking to the dispersion. So he's speaking to Jews, Christians, and non-Christian Jews, okay? And he's trying to get the synagogue Jews, the non-Christian Jews, to have a little more understanding of what's going on. And so he comes from a theocentric view, That's why Martin Luther didn't like it. He saw this as a works-oriented book. It is not at all. It is not. This is N.T. Wright's book, After You Believe, would be a pretty good title to put to the letter of James. You believe. You've committed. Jesus is Lord. You've been baptized. Okay. Now, after you believe, how do you live? And that's what James is addressing. And he comes at it really hard. I really appreciated Sarah Barton this morning and how she talked about how this is tough. This is difficult.
it's easy for me to talk about it, but it's another thing. And that's what James is all about. Not talking about it, but doing it. And doing it in community. Doing it in community. We don't do this by ourselves. And in doing it in community, then the larger community is better able to give glory to God rather than glory to a particular individual. Well, okay, thank you very much. We'll take up with the two last ones and another text tomorrow.